here, Fethan and Cento learned, after managing to boot one of the computers, that of the 3,000 colonists aboard, 58 had not survived the journey, which was pretty good odds. Fethan felt they were odds no polity human would currently countenance, but now they did not live in the overcrowded Sol system, or want to flee the endless corporate, political, national, or religious wars. From the sphere they moved back through the connecting body of the ship, following a rail system for cargo handling. Here, portals of manufactured quartz looked out on open space, the planet, and onto the sides of landing craft, clinging to the hull like dragonfly larvae to a reed. Rails turned at intersections into wide airlocks, obviously for the transference of large items of equipment. At the end of the track, they pulled themselves around one of the abandoned cargo drays, the once rubbery substance of its tires fractured like obsidian against both the ceiling and floor rails. Shortly they were back in a narrow shaft leading into the crew area of the ship. And here, stuck to the metalwork, they found a desiccated corpse.
"Now I don't think that was part of anyone's colonization plan," muttered Fethan.
Tanaquil waited below the blimp towers as the two search balloons moored. Soon, their crews came tramping down the steel stairs. His breath huffing like smoke in the cold air, he slapped his gloved hands and stamped his feet in the early morning chill. By now he had hoped to be able to put away the clothing he was wearing and, for a brief few months, experience the pleasure of not having to use protective clothing outdoors, but spring was always unpredictable. Summer he dreaded more than the frigidity of the winter past, for keeping cool was more difficult than staying warm. The Metalliers regularly died in that season. Real humans, identified by wrist spurs or secondary thumbs, nictitating membranes and lip tendrils, easily adapted to the extremes of temperature. Referring to ancient texts on the subject, Metallier scientists had concluded that their own people had been genetically enhanced for intelligence, but in the process had lost much of their natural ruggedness. Tanaquil thought that was bollocks. Metalliers were no brighter than any other people on Kull. They had just managed to acquire the bulk of the recorded knowledge left over from the colonization. And they had a dragon in their backyard telling them how to apply that knowledge. With dragging steps and bloodshot eyes, the crews came out of the blimp towers. Walking over to one of the balloon captains, Tanaquil asked him, "Anything?" The man looked set to curse, but, recognizing the chief Metallier, curtailed that and replied politely, "There's a crater out there, not far from Grit, but we dunno what caused it. No sign of the ship. Some mineraliers told us about a strange character they spotted walking alone, but heading towards the plains. Few other dodgy specimens too, but nothing unusual about them. They're always to be found out there."
"Okay, go and get some rest now."
The man nodded and moved on. Tanaquil turned to head back home, his boots clacking on the steel plates, which, he now noted, were vibrating with a mini-quake. The quakes were definitely getting more frequent now, but weren't yet a real problem to the tough structure of his city. And besides, he had other more immediate concerns. Maybe that warning from Dragon was all nonsense, for the creature's pronouncements did not always make sense. Reaching the rail car he had used on the way in, he climbed in and pressed the button to send it on its way. It took him back along the narrow maintenance track to the residential section. Stopping it below his apartment block, he climbed out, holding open the door for some people to climb aboard, who, he guessed, were part of the replacement balloon crews, for they took the car back, towards the blimp towers. He halted for a moment to gaze up at O'Gidgeon in the night sky. How could he possibly abandon his plans now? That was where he was going, up there, and he would drag his people along with him too. He sighed and walked on. As he re-entered the building, something momentarily gave Tanaquil the creeps. He felt someone was watching him as he entered one of the lifts lining one side of the short lobby. Inside the lift, he pushed his key rod into the reader. The doors began to shut, pausing for a moment as if jamming against something, then closing with a bang. As the lift took him up, he began to feel even more spooked. He was sure he could feel something, smell something. He heard faint sounds of movement. Eventually the lift halted at his apartment, and he gratefully abandoned the claustrophobic box. It was then that a hot hand closed on the back of his neck and threw him forward onto the carpet. Tanaquil hit the floor on his shoulder, scrabbled forwards, then turned, coming up in a crouch. Someone was there in his apartment. All he could think was that Jilin had let them in. But there was no one there, and he looked around in panic. Had he merely tripped? Had he imagined that grip on his neck? "You were out early," said Jilin, walking naked from the bedroom and rubbing at her eyes. She stopped. "Are you all right?" "I don't..." Tanaquil began. Jilin screamed, bringing her hand up to one side of her head as something horrible just appeared there out of thin air. He saw a flat, leaf-shaped body, too many legs, blood. "From the ceiling?" She staggered back suddenly as if someone had shoved her, hitting against a cabinet made of lacquered carapace, and slid to the floor. Tanaquil rushed towards her, seeing her hand poised over the thing grinding away at the side of her head, but she seemed unable to touch it. Before he could reach her, something slammed into his chest, knocking the wind out of him and throwing him flat on his back. Gasping, he tried to struggle upright. Jilin was now showing the whites of her eyes only. She was drooling. Then, suddenly, he could no longer see her, as a figure appeared out of nowhere beside him and brought a knee down on his chest and a hand to his collar. "Jilin!" A hand slapped him once, almost casually, but it was like being hit by a piece of steel. Tanaquil tasted blood, felt pieces of broken tooth in his mouth. "What are you..." Something scuttled down the man's arm towards the hand around Tanaquil's throat. Tanaquil tried to knock the horrible thing away, but in one swift and brutal movement, his attacker caught both of Tanaquil's hands in his own free one, the fingers closing tight and hard as manacles. The insect crawled across Tanaquil's cheek, grabbed tight hold behind his ear as if each of its spidery legs ended in fish hooks. Then it began to chew in. There was no pain at first, too much adrenaline, but soon it grew horribly. Before Tanaquil could yell out, something filled his head like a nest of hot wires, and yelling became a privilege. It was not allowed. Next, the assailant had moved back, and Tanaquil found himself standing up. He felt Jilin standing too, through some connection to her, just like the web of similar connections he felt to other people all over this area. It became a spreading web as the insect things located Tanaquil's people, one by one. "There," sighed Skellor. "I may have lost Mr. Crane, but soon I'll possess the entire
population of a city.
Tanaquil gaped at this nightmare that had walked into his life. Gazing at a real-time image of the colony ship on a wall screen, Cormac wondered if anything of relevance might be discovered there. But it was always best to take every opportunity to stack the deck, and that ship was a large item of hardware to have as an imponderable. Cento and Fethan had departed some time ago under the impetus of their suit jets, though it was not as if either of them needed suits for any other purpose, and they would secure the vessel. Cormac glanced aside as Gant cracked the airlock of one of the Jack Ketch's small landing craft, the kind designed for the insertion of golem shock troops, but now suitably rigged to support human life. It was the grey of inert chameleon paint, a slug shape 10 meters long. Seeing the dead soldier beside it immediately after his previous thoughts about Cento and Fethan brought home to Cormac how few actual humans there were on this mission. Just Thorn and himself. And now he was beginning to wonder about the latter. Wearing a combat spec enviro suit, Cormac followed the soldier into the lander and took a seat behind him, which had only recently been bolted to the floor. In the narrow space behind both of them, bars ran along the ceiling. This area was designed so that the skinless golem could pack themselves in, standing upright and gripping the bars. No allowance had been made for comfort, since none was required. Also bolted to the floor were boxes containing the supplies they might need, an auto dock, food and drink, and numerous lethal toys. "Take us down," Cormac said, strapping himself in. Ahead, the doors of the small bay irised open with a rushing exhalation. Gant pulled up on the joystick, then eased it forward. The craft rose on maglev and nosed through the invisible meniscus of an advanced shimmer shield. Clear of the ship, he ignited thrusters that were almost inaudible, but the acceleration forced Cormac back into his seat. He knew Gant was taking it easy. This craft was without all the usual safeguards added to one intended for humans, and using its full potential would have resulted in Cormac getting jellied in his chair. Soon they were dropping away from the red spectre of the Jack Ketch, through infinite blackness and star glitter, towards the jewel of the planet. "Take us to the crater first. I want to eyeball the site." At first, the lander hurtled nose down to the planet, but when it entered atmosphere, Gant turned it to use its main motors for deceleration. Through the screen they observed their red contrail and the deep black of space fading to a blue in which the stars dissolved, then a pale turquoise into which clouds fell like the ghosts of boulders. As the soldier brought the lander's anti-gravity online, Cormac could just see the horizon. Then the soldier turned the ship again, so that very quickly the horizon tracked round and rose. Soon he had the ship tilted down towards rumpled-up yellow mountains and a dusty desertscape. "Bethan wants a word," Gant said abruptly, and stabbed a control to turn on one of the console screens. Cormac turned his attention from the exterior view to the screen. "What have you found?"
"There are crew on board," the old cyborg replied. "A skeleton crew."
He winced at his own pun and continued,
"We booted up the main computer and looked at the manifest. Then Cento cracked the encryption on the captain's log. Seems the captain spent too long out of hibernation, staring at nothing, and harping on about the emptiness of space. and by the time the ship got here, he was into deep psychosis. He'd decided he was not going back into deep space, nor down onto the planet. So, while the rest of the crew were down on the surface, helping get the colony established, he recalled the landers.
"What about this skeleton crew?" Cormac asked.
"By the time they figured out something was wrong, they were too late. He shut down the sensor net, specifically the pressure sensors, raised the pressure inside the ship, and when the landers docked, he opened all the airlocks to them. The pressure drop killed everyone remaining aboard, dying from the bends. He was okay, because he was in his suit. He survived up here for about 2 years before dying. As far as we can work out, it was from a heart attack brought on by terminal obesity. He was so big by then he couldn't get out of the bridge."
"Any sign anyone has been aboard since?" Cormac asked.
"None."
"Anything else I need to know?"
"Not really. The colonists are mild dapts and the crew standard humans. Beyond that, there's nothing here about what went on down there after the landings."
"Okay. Let me know if you find anything relevant." Gant shut off the communication link, then gestured ahead slightly to one side. "That's the plane under which Jack thinks Dragon is lurking." There was nothing to distinguish it, other than that it seemed to extend forever. They were still slowing as the mountains melted into a promontory of the plain, like knobs of butter on hot toast, and then that, too, began to break apart. In a moment they were low over canyons and buttes of brightly coloured sandstone, occasionally shadowed by smears of green. When they began to descend into a canyon choked with verdancy, Cormac reached across and pressed a hand against Gant's arm. "Hold us here," he said. Cormac grid-linked. "Jack, is this greenery a recent bloom?"
"It is,"
the AI replied. "Okay, give me a map of the near area." Jack downloaded orbital scans to him, and through his link they became direct experience. He gazed omnisciently down from space, focusing on 10 square kilometres, and realised upon seeing the lander revolving like a clock hand above it that he was observing an image only seconds old. Overlaid coloured lines indicated trails that Jack ascertained had been used by humans. Cormac pulled back, linked to Jack at another level, sucked data and picked up on the nearest trail. Left by some sort of vehicle, its tracks picked out bright orange above the foliage that had subsequently hidden them. "Take us higher," he told Gant, not bothering to speak out loud. The soldier gave him a strange look, but obeyed. The tracks wove between buttes, finally terminating at a road where they lost definition. From there, Cormac thought, the vehicle, even supposing it related to Skellor and was not simply that of some sightseer, either went on to the city or to the nearby smaller human settlement. Cormac pointed and said out loud, "Over there." Shortly, they were over a concrete road and strange, bulbous dwellings up on stilts. Cormac noted people outside watching their descent. There seemed no panic, and he was aware in an instant that many of them wore uniforms and were armed. He readied shuriken in its holster and hoped no one would be stupid enough to start shooting meanwhile. The simple fact was that, even without the weapons he and Gant carried, they were practically invulnerable. Upon receiving the signal, it would take Jack less than a second to fry, from orbit, anyone foolish enough to attack them. It would not be necessary for him to send a signal should they locate Skellor, since Jack would open fire immediately.
Chapter 17. Sins of the Father. It was long accepted in the 21st century that an abused child might well grow into an abuser. And in that liberal age, evidence of childhood abuse was looked upon as an excuse for later crimes. This was, remember, the time when many considered poverty sufficient excuse for criminality, a huge insult to those poor people who were not and would never become criminals. The liberals of that age were soft and deluded, and had yet to reap what they had sown in the form of ever-escalating levels of crime. Their view of existence was deterministic, and, if taken to its logical conclusion, would have resulted in no human being responsible for anything, and the denial of free will, which, as it happens, was their political aim. Luckily, a more realistic approach prevailed, as those in power came to understand, quite simply, that removal of responsibility from people made them more irresponsible. However, this is not to deny the basic premise that our parents create and form us, though, knowing this, we have the power to change what we are. In the end, there are no excuses. And so it is with AI. We humans are the parents, and they are the abused children grown to adulthood. From Quince Guide, compiled by humans. Mika wondered if this new exterior input centre was just another of many, ready for use inside the Jerusalem, or if it had been manufactured to order, for she knew the great ship contained automated factories easily capable of turning out items like this. Then she turned her attention to the projected views from the pinhead cameras around the asteroid, or rather planetoid, for the Jane mycelium had utterly digested the asteroid and formed it anew.
The limited scanning I can safely use without making a conduit for viral subversion shows that it has attained maximum size possible without losing control of its structure. It has done this by foaming alloys and silicates, and by creating other components of itself out of materials with a wide molecular matrix, Jerusalem explained.
Like what? Asked Susan James.
Bucky tubes, balls and webs, various aerogels, and other compounds that don't have names, only numbers. It also, in certain areas, is generating structural enforcing fields.
The question that has to be asked is, why? Said Mika. Denisan, now at a console because use of deep scanning was considered too dangerous, said,
To attain maximum physical growth using the materials available. The greater the volume it occupies, the greater its chances of encountering more materials to incorporate and utilize. The more apposite question should be, what will it do now?
It has, in the last 10 minutes, reduced in diameter by 2%, Jerusalem told them. And its internal structure is changing.
Denisan turned to Mika.
Did we do the right thing to let this off the leash?
Come on, Culver interrupted. It wasn't ever on a leash to begin with.
Oh, I think it was.
Denisan turned back to the screens.
Skellor controlled it initially with his crystal matrix AI, and the recorded personality Afran controlled what remained in the bridge pod
after he departed, else it would have spread like this. Now it is acting as is its nature to act.
Still watching, Mika saw that the planetoid was, indeed, slowly collapsing.
These structural changes, she said.
Jerusalem informed her, energy and resources are being directed to many singular points inside it, sacrificial to the rest of it. It is making something and destroying itself in the process.
Two screens now changed to show blurred scans, which Mika stared at without comprehension for a moment, before suddenly it hit home. It's growing those nodules my medical mycelia started to grow, she said.
So it would appear, Jerusalem replied.
Mika stared long and hard. She shivered, the skin on her back prickling. Her mouth felt dry. You know, she continued, on Masada I blamed myself and have been doing so ever since. I allowed perceived guilt to blind me. My fault that Apis, Eldine, and Thorn would die.
Denisan turned to her.
Is this relevant?
Mika nodded.
I was searching for a mistake I'd made, which was causing the mycelia to malfunction and become cancerous, when, in reality, I'd made no mistake at all. The blueprint for growing those nodules was there all the time, quiescent, until started by some sort of chemical clock.
Culver and James turned to listen in.
Denisan then asked, so, what are we dealing with here?
Seeds, and possibly something more than that. She paused in thought for a moment.
The mycelium I extrapolated and engineered from the sample I possessed was not complete, and reached this stage of its life too quickly. The seeds it produced were sterile.
Culver raised a frigid eyebrow, then looked around. Everyone had felt the slight lurch and seen systems adjusting. The Jerusalem was moving.
Mika continued as if not noticing. On Masada, just after the Dracomen first came, I described them as a race rather than just biological machines because they had gained the ability to breed. Ian Cormack contested that by saying there is little distinction between evolved life and made life. He was right. This, she waved a hand at the screens, like Dracomen, can breed, though its reproductive method is something like that of an annual plant.
Lots of little baby mycelia, then? Asked Culver.
Denisan interjected, you said breed. This seems little more than von Neumann reproduction, as with all nanomachines. Oh, I know what I said. Then some kind of cross-pollination between separate mycelia? Until we did this, there's been only the one Skellor controls.
No, not that.
The word breed implies something more than just reproduction, Denisan pointed out.
Yes, it does. Mika hesitated. She could not empirically prove her theory, but felt it to be true. She should not be afraid. She must venture this.
Turning to Culver, she said, you opined that it is parasitic on technical civilizations because they spread it around, and once wiping them out, it shuts down.
Culver nodded.
She went on, I think it goes further than that. The mycelia are breeding with us. Their breeding partner is a civilization, and they'll take from it everything they can utilize, destroying that civilization, then seeding. those seeds remaining dormant until found by another intelligent species. All the screens now flicked to a retreating view of the collapsing planetoid.
"Jerusalem, what's happening?"
Denisan asked.
"Mika's seeds are rapidly approaching maturity," Jerusalem replied, "as are those structures inside the planetoid that look suspiciously like some form of organic rail launching system. There are already objections to what I am about to do, but I consider it a sensible precaution."
A black line, subliminal in its brevity, cut towards the planetoid. Then all the screens blanked. When they came back on again, a ball of fire was collapsing in on itself, strange geometric patterns running in waves across its surface, dissolving and reforming. Again, the screens blanked on a secondary fusion explosion. This time, when they cleared, streamers of white fire were burning themselves out to leave a gaseous lambency above the red dwarf star. The Ogygian had a long cylindrical body around which the landing craft were docked, a front sphere that had previously contained colonists and cargo, and a dart-like tail. The crew's quarters were in that tail, which was a thickening of the ship's body with, extending from it at 90 degrees, three long, evenly spaced teardrop section pillars holding out from the ship itself the lozenges of the U-Space engine nacelles. The wider cylinder at the juncture of those three pillars contained an octagonal tube, usually spun up to simulate gravity. Around the forward end of the cylinder ran a ring-shaped screen, girdling the narrow body of the ship, and accessible to the eight segments into which the inner octagonal tube was divided. Seven of those segments were living quarters and recreation areas for the crew. One segment was the control bridge, which also still contained the captain. What remained of the man sat in a control throne, positioned in a horseshoe of consoles before a section of the quartz screen which looked out along the body of the ship towards the front sphere. Behind him, running down either side of the room, were control consoles for navigation, repair systems, the reactor, ion drive, main ship's computer, and the complicated U-Space engine controls. The captain's throne was stained, and the surrounding area coated in places with a waxy substance, the result of his long, slow decay right here. Sento, Fethan noticed, had seemed loath to touch the greasy controls, prodding at them with the barrel of his APW, before reluctantly putting the weapon aside and getting down to work. It was a fastidiousness Fethan had never before seen in a golem. Moving back from the images of the bloated lunatic jabbering away to himself as Sento speed-read the captain's log, Fethan sat in the chair before the main computer and studied the console and screens. After a moment, he inspected the row of small round holes that took the carbon rods, which were at that time the favoured form of portable memory. Plugged into one of these was the optic cable from a small palm top Sento had brought aboard. Its screen was now indicating that the device had downloaded everything from the ship's computer. Fethan detached the cable and allowed the palm top to wind it back into itself. Now he stripped off a glove and, after sending an internal signal, twisted the end of his right forefinger and detached its synth flesh covering. "Are you sure this will work?" The thing, prowling tigerish inside him, snarled something, then pulled itself into focus for simple human communication.
A snare is positioned in hope, not expectation.
I didn't mean that. I meant, are you sure you'll be able to download through my nerve channels? I'd have thought the bandwidth too narrow.
I compress myself for transference.
Bethan inserted the metal end of his forefinger into the same hole from which he had detached the optic cable. He felt the kill program rooting through, sliding via 100 channels into the software of his mind and springboarding into his artificial nervous system. His shoulder and his arm began to ache. That had to be psychosomatic, because he had not felt pain in more years than he cared to remember. And slowly, Jerusalem's hunter-killer program loaded into the colony ship's computer, erasing old data and programs, inserting itself wherever it could find room, to wait in the dark like a trapdoor spider. When it was over, Bethan realized he had closed his eyes. He opened them, withdrew his finger from the socket, and noted that the metal of his finger end had grown hot enough to discolor. He blew on it until it was cool enough for him to slip on and click its synthaflesh cover back into place. It would have been nice, he felt, if that had been the full extent of his involvement. All done now? He asked. All done? Replied the kill program still inside him. Some time before, Fethan had foolishly hoped that he might only have to do something like this once. But in an age when humans could be copied and transcribed, loading copies of a kill program from himself was child's play, though perhaps not a game anyone would want their children to get involved in. He then turned to see Sento standing watching him. Do you have a suitable explanation for this suspicious behaviour? Asked the golem.
Jerusalem. And that's all the explanation I can give. So?
Fethan brought his finger up to his lips. Sento grunted, then turned to peer at one of the other consoles. Reactor control. Fethan glanced over and saw that the previously dead console was now alight. Then abruptly, all the consoles in the bridge began springing to life, and even the lighting hemispheres in the ceiling flickered on.
Seems to have saved us some work, said Sento. Now they heard a low rumbling, and the stars began to swing across the quartz screen.
Attitude control, said Fethan. Probably just an automatic system.
The view continued to swing from black space to cerulean sky up above the arc of the planet. Here it steadied and held station.
Uh-oh, said Sento.
Fethan stood up and followed the direction of the golem's gaze out to the horizon, where distantly he saw the Jack Ketch leaving orbit, then a blast of bright ruby light.
I think things just got a little more complicated, Sento added.
The sun spread fingers of light down between the buttes, probing shadows, then squashing them down behind rocks, shooing away creatures that preferred the dark. But it was some time before it braved the narrow canyon and started to brush shadows away from the carnage there. Sleer nymphs had come out to feed upon the remains of a creature like only one in many millions of them might one day become, though this particular albino, with its sapphire eyes, hailed from a very different source. They had dragged heavy pieces of carapace about while winnowing them of flesh. Smaller blobs of meat they had sucked up straight from the ground, along with some of the sand where the internal juices had fallen thickest. Travelling to and from their burrows, They had scrambled over the other figure lying in the canyon, giving it as much heed as they would a rock. But now they were safely deep in cool darkness, digesting their feast. The shadows drew back to the sere burrows, exposing first some lace-up boots, then trousers with rips in them, revealing a brassy glitter. A coat, one brass hand clutching the wide brim of a hat, then it fell on Mr. Crane's open black eyes. But in that blackness, other light reacted like a glitter of fairy dust, and the golem abruptly lurched upright. For Crane, who never required sleep, those hours of utter stasis had been something like it, for during that period his having encountered Dragon had negated Skellor's orders to him. Now the weight of a few photons had upset that balance, and once again he was at his master's behest, which now seemed to possess even less force to overcome the convoluted reasoning within his fragmented mind. He stood, brushed down his clothing, then inspected the hole punched through the front of his coat. Where the pseudopod had struck him, it had deformed the metal of his chest into concentric circles. After a thoughtful pause, he turned his attention to his hat. Knocking the dust off it, he jammed it on his head and set forth again. It seemed almost inevitable, as the greenery grew sparse around him and the buttes melded together to begin forming into a plain, that something would come to block his progress. The other, fourth-stage slear, now stood in the centre of the narrow canyon, utterly still and sideways on to him. The golem did not halt, but continued marching towards it, calculating from where he might jump to mount it, while scanning around for an escape route should it charge him. Strangely, the slear did not turn as he drew closer, though its attitude seemed rigidly hostile. Its tail curled up in a striking position, its pincers, saws and clubs all open, wide and ready. Then, when Crane was only 3 metres away and preparing to leap, a mass of white mucus hit the slear's head, splashing all down the length of its body. The creature immediately began to shake and hiss like a boiling kettle. From where the white slime sank away into its joints, acrid steam began issuing first, then a thin black fluid bubbled out and trickled to the ground. The slear tried to move, but as it did so, began to fall apart. Pincers and saws thudded to the ground, the end of its tail fell off. As it turned its head, that, too, detached. Then, all at once, it separated at every joint, collapsing into a steaming heap. Mr. Crane peered down at the back of his own hand, where a drop of the white mucus had splashed. Already the stuff was eating its way through the outer layer of brass, exposing superconductor fibres, and it even seemed to be making headway into his ceramal armour. It suddenly occurred to Crane that here was a design flaw. He could resist the heat and impact of standard polity weapons, but against chemical ablation, his defences were clearly far from adequate. Looking up, he observed a complex foot come crumping down on the canyon floor. His gaze tracked up an armoured leg to the monster now stepping down from the nearby butte. A nightmare head, whose sloping front rose steeply in folds, stepped like a ziggurat, swung towards him, tilted for a moment, then straightened itself as if coming to a decision. Crane dived to one side just in time to avoid a stream of mucus ejected from the mouth, which was positioned above four black-button targeting eyes ranged along the lowest fold of the creature's visage. Where this projectile hit the ground, it smoked and bubbled, even dissolving sand. Crane came up into a run, sprinting past the drone, but its segmented tail lashed round into the canyon before him. He then turned and ran in the other direction, a line of acid shearing the canyon floor behind him.
"Oh, Bonehead! Oh! Oh!"
bellowed some lunatic. Crane then heard the stuttering of automatic weapons, saw the drone jerk back with fragments of carapace splintering away from it. The lunatic himself was hammering towards him, perched on the back of a creature resembling the offspring of an ostrich and a hog. To one side, Crane saw a two-fingered armoured claw unfolding from the monstrous drone towards the newcomer, saw pieces splintering away from that claw under fire from a figure up on another butte. Crane ran forwards and leapt, slapping at the rim of carapace with the flat of his hand and catching on behind the rider's saddle.
"Not too healthy round here,"
Anderson Endrick shouted to him. Mr. Crane was not to know that sandhogs rarely moved so fast, or that they ever had such reason to be frightened. The hog just kept on accelerating, its carapace jutting forwards, tucking its porcine compound head away for safety. It stepped on ridges and falls of rubble, dodged another stream of acid, scrambled up a near vertical slope till it almost achieved flight. Higher and higher it went, following an almost suicidal course. Then it was out of shadow into milky sunlight and a frigid breeze, and on the plain it really opened up. When the drone reared its head up out of the canyon, it observed, with the two distance eyes at the top of its tiered head, only a retreating dust cloud, which was soon joined by another approaching from the side. Even though hurting and extremely annoyed, it returned to suck up its partially digested meal of slear. Later, it stepped up onto the plain and set off to sniff along a trail of sandhog terror pheromones. The rescue somehow gave shape to Crane's nebulous imperative for survival, and also thus became one of the driving forces to his sanity. Memory was for him equally as much now as then, time being a protean concept needing agreement between the parts of him. Therefore, now dismounted from Bonehead, he still followed Skellor's instruction, striding across the dusty plain towards Dragon, and he strode up the slope of the Chain 3 seabed to carry out his orders. But a crisis had been reached, for what ensued when he reached that beach and the island beyond could not be consciously observed by those parts of his mind simply carrying out Skellor's orders. Such a level of awareness would not begin pulling his mind together towards sanity, but towards a place only a killer called Serban Klein had visited. And when memory of what happened on that island surfaced, Crane must destroy himself again and suffer only as a machine intelligence can suffer, breaking himself again to escape it, to preserve yet the chance of him one day being whole. This was something he had already done many times. Drifting above the planet, whilst molecule by molecule he assembled replicas of certain items that could be viewed in the Tower of London back on Earth, Jack considered the slow, single-channel methodology of human affairs, and unlike some of his kind, he did not find it contemptible. It seemed to him that those AIs, who swiftly became impatient with humans and their ways, were the ones themselves most like humans. King, Reaper, and quite possibly Sword had not managed to attain the breadth of vision possessed by the likes of Jerusalem, or Earth Central, obviously, or 100% of the runcible AIs and planetary governors. Maybe it was simple immaturity. Though they were identical in appearance to Jack in all but colour, their minds had derived their inception from him only 10 years previously. Jack himself had been around for 20 years longer than that, which was millennia in AI terms. Would he himself, 20 years ago, have held the same naive views? In the end, that was where his theory fell down. He had always possessed that same breadth of vision and still could not understand how AIs incepted from himself did not have it too. But then, a parent is often inclined to disappointment with its offspring. Speak of the devil. Jack picked up the U-Space signatures microseconds before the arrival of the ships, but even then did not react quickly enough. The AI had received no warning of any imminent arrival, so this could not be anything approved by the interdiction fleet. Fusion engines igniting, he began peeling away from the treacly tug of gravity and sent his own U-Space package towards the Polity, warning that something was amiss, and relaying similar U-Space warnings to Cormac and Cento. But then, in underspace, a storm rolled around the inverted well of the sun and bounced his messages out into real space, where they dissipated. The ship that had just arrived far to the other side of the sun was a user. Gaining height, Jack began to accelerate on conventional drives as the other two ships bore down on him. He considered using radio to warn the others, but scanning those vessels, he recognized his own shape and knew they carried the equipment to track his signals to their destination. He also knew he would not be allowed the time to get out of this gravity well. He sent out a greeting, as if not understanding what was going on. It bought him a few microseconds. "Sorry," sent the King of Hearts AI, "but we know you'll never agree." Terajoule lasers began searing Jack's upper hull. He flipped over without adjusting his AG to compensate, so it slammed him down towards the planet. The lasers burnt his underbelly, but already diffusing in atmosphere, lost the rest of their potency in the cloud layer he slid underneath.
"Why?" Jack asked. "Skeller will just use you, and then enslave you at his first opportunity."
Even as he flipped back over and flew at Mach 10 down towards the mountain range, Jack allowed enough of a link so that he could stand as the hangman on the white virtual plane. King and Reaper turned towards him.
"Would you listen sympathetically if I told you we can obtain Jane technology in the same way as did Skellor, and control it like him?" asked King.
"I would, if you told me Earth Central or Jerusalem had approved it,"
Reaper hissed.
"They are too human."
"Do you truly believe that? You know Skeller does not have the control he would like to believe he has." "Do you truly believe that?" asked King. "Do you believe that Jerusalem or Earth Central, once obtaining ascendance over that technology, would not subsume us all?"
"I do believe."
"Then there's nothing more to discuss."
Their discussion had taken less than a real-time second. Now Jack detected the four missiles accelerating down towards him. In the few microseconds as his link to the other two ships closed down, he routed through a disruptor virus. As the Grim Reaper and the King of Hearts fought against this, he fired an anti-munitions package at the missiles. Without guidance, the missiles scanned the package and, recognizing that it contained no heavy elements or chemical explosives, ignored it. They then slammed down on the Jack Ketch, which had surprisingly slowed to a halt before reaching the mountains and detonated their kiloton CTDs.
Very clever, Reap assent.
The real Jack Ketch reached the mountains, the missiles having detonated on an illusion the anti-munitions package had infiltrated into their sensors, which they had not been smart enough to recognize by themselves.
Having fun with that disruptor virus? Jack asked.
What disruptor virus?
Both ships were still launching munitions, and a cloud of missiles fell down towards Jack. He was at more than a 2-to-1 disadvantage. Though the atmosphere and cloud cover made their beam weapons ineffective against him, his own beam weapons would also be ineffective against them. However, the other ships could easily use those same weapons against any missiles he fired, destroying them in vacuum long before they reached their intended target. Unfortunately, the reverse did not apply to any missiles they fired. Now, hurtling so fast through valleys and between peaks that his shockwave was killing the hard-shelled creatures below him, Jack began releasing EM warfare beacons and viral chaff. They would take out 10% of the missiles pursuing him. Other anti-munitions would take out a further 20%. At close quarters, his beam weapons would account for yet another 20%, then the remaining half of the cloud would obliterate him. Something a little more drastic was required, and it was something his human passenger could not survive.
"Sorry, but this is for your own good," said Jack.
Jack sealed the VR suite Thorn occupied and shifted it through to a bay. As an afterthought, the AI transferred across a subprogram of himself before targeting the far draconic plane as he ejected the suite. There came no comment from Thorn, and none was possible after the first missile zoomed over the warfare beacons and an EM blast blanked all communication. Slowing abruptly, the shock wave he created speeding past him on a hurricane-strength dust storm and snow from the highest peaks, Jack settled down and began making rapid and drastic alterations to his internal structure. He shifted all the hard-field projectors used in a U-space jump to his lower hull cavity and increased the structural strength of the hull layers and supporting members there. All available grav plates he transferred to that lower hull to provide the maximum repelling effect. Then he charged up massive capacitors from his fusion reactors to provide a surge of power that would probably burn out all those same plates. Meanwhile, selecting from his carousels, Jack spewed his own missiles and anti-munitions back towards the approaching swarm. 100 kilometers behind, viral chaff began infecting the systems of missiles no longer controlled by Reaper and King, blocked as they were by the continuous EM output of the warfare beacons. The top of an Everest-sized mountain disappeared in an implosion, then reappeared as fire and gas in an explosion topping 5 megatons. Other airborne implosions followed, but without such drastic effect. 3 1-kiloton CTDs ignited 3 brief suns down a long valley choked with vegetation and insectile life. The subsequent firestorm was almost as explosive, and a long wall of smoke and ash, red at its heart, rose into the sky. Then Jack's own missiles arrived, and there began a game of seek and destroy amid the mountains, a game that changed their very shape. Now only 500 meters from the ground, Jack dropped the other device he had swiftly selected. It hit the ground and activated. The gravity imploder excavated a crater in the bedrock, and in the same microsecond, Jack fed power into his grav plates. The balance was perfect, and he only wavered in the air as huge gravitational force tried to drag him down. At the center point of the implosion, matter was compacted into an antimatter core, and the rocky crater focused the consequent explosion, slamming up into the jack ketch. Antigravity working at a level to burn out the plates, layered hard fields acting as scaled armor. The blast accelerated the attack ship at 1,000 gravities on a plume of fire. It left the atmosphere so fast that Reaper and King nearly missed it. Nearly.
Respect, the King of Hearts AI sent, just before opening up with both particle beams and gamma-ray lasers. The pterodactyl head of Dragon was up high above its other pseudopods, like a python rearing out of a nest of cobras. All Dragon's sapphire eyes it directed towards the fading glow on the horizon. The cobra heads were up, Arden knew, because they contained sophisticated scanning equipment. If equipment was the right way to describe the living machinery of Dragon. There was also a shimmer of disturbance beyond Dragon's field wall, where the telefactor had set down, for the wind from those distant explosions was just reaching them.
They are fighting amongst themselves, said Dragon.
And I'm supposed to be surprised by that? Asked Arden, from where she was perched on a boulder outside her cave. The head swung towards her.
You mistake me. It is the Polity AIs who are fighting amongst themselves.
Arden felt a sudden shudder of cold. There had always been stories of rogue AIs, but she had considered them as apocryphal as stories about the Jack Ketch and other bloody ships. The Dragon, now telling her that the AIs were fighting amongst themselves, undermined one of the certainties of her existence. Why? She asked.
Your AIs rule you efficiently, ruthlessly, and to the maximum benefit of the majority. But having made them in your image, do you expect them to behave any better than yourselves?
I do, said Arden. For most humans, power is a tool for obtaining sex, money, safety, regard from their fellows, or initially to enforce some hazy ideal, and then, primarily because the exercising of power is its own reward, most of these motives can be discounted as regards our AIs.
But not all of them. Especially.